another one of our Visiting Professor Lecture Series. I'm Jane McCarthy from the Office of Training and Communication. And we're actually still located over in Parkland, by the way. So all the training activities, educational courses that are going on that you go to, that we're putting on here in this building, but our people, our staff people, are still over at Parkland. So when you see Chris and Ginny and Linda, they're all, you know, coming. So it's a real challenge for us in Task Run. But anyway, as many of you know, the Visiting Professor, CEDAR Visiting Professor Lecture Series has been going on for about four or five years now. And this program is sponsored by my office, and we bring in primarily academicians to talk specifically to smaller groups, although this is a very large group, to talk about issues that you're dealing with that in your work. And please, if you have someone that you'd like to bring in, get in touch with me or Jean Giroux over in ArtCom. Now we're doing something a little different. Usually, as I said, this is usually a small, intimate group, and we don't video conference to different places, but we are video conferencing to a room upstairs, 4270. And then we're also video conferencing to Metro Park North.
Metro Park North 2,
and we're attempting to video conference over to a CDRH at Gaither Road, but that didn't work. So the Gaither Road people are going over, we hope, to the Metro Park North site. So I welcome you out there in video conference land. Welcome to our conference this morning. And before our speaker begins, I wanted to give you a gift. Normally, of course, you give this at the end. But for two reasons, I know you're going to be a grand success, so we can count on that. And so I'll give it, and but it's something we hope that you might be able to find useful, a pointer. And you see it says CEDAR on it, as opposed to FDA, which is like really an in thing. There's your little case. And Dr. Redman will now give a more appropriate formal introduction of your speaker this morning.
Thank you. I won't stand up. Okay. I've known Dr. Simon for a while, and he is a chief of the biometric research branch at NCI. He holds a doctoral degree in applied mathematics and computer science from Washington University in St. Louis. He's published over 400 papers. I'm not sure how, but he has, and developed many of the statistical methods used in cancer clinical trials. Since 1998, Dr. Simon has focused on application of genomic data to cancer research, and his software package, BRB Array Tools, is widely used for analysis of microarray data. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just stand up here for a moment so, before the, just for my introduction. I'd like to thank Alan Rudman, really, for inviting me to give this talk, and I'd like to thank Sue Jane Wang, because a lot of the work I've done here has sort of been helped very much and stimulated very much by my interactions with people at the FDA, as well as interaction with people in industry. And I was involved in the pharmacogenomics workshop that was held last, I think it was March, and all of the preparations that went into that. I was very close working together with industry and FDA people, and I found it very stimulating and useful. So and I'm happy to be here. The last time I was here, however, I was here playing golf. I used to play golf on this campus. And, I'm very glad to hear that the golf course is coming back. So. Now, I'll stand aside here so that I don't block the slides for the video conferencing. I guess the main part about this slide is the URL of my website. I will post this presentation on my website, and as I posted a lot of presentation, the PowerPoint files on this website, and there's also a lot of reprints and technical reports related to what I'm going to be talking about that are in the technical reports section of the website there. That's also our software that that's free for non-commercial use is available at that website. I've included just a couple of things here, not really for going over during the talk, but just so if you do download the presentation, you can have a list of some of the references that are sort of related to what I'm going to be talking about here. So my objectives today in this talk are to talk about how to use biological measurements to enhance the development and utilization of effective therapeutics, how biological measurements or biomarkers can be used really to enhance the development and utilization of essentially new therapeutics. What should constitute validation for such biological measurements? I'd like to clarify some misleading terminology. I'd like to challenge what I view as some erroneous conventional wisdom about biomarkers and validation issues. And I'd like to try to take a step to transitioning from generalities in talking about these issues to identifying specific and practical designs and analysis plans that, that sponsors can use in actual development. I use the term biological measurements, and there's a lot of, I think there is a lot of confusion, and I'd like to try to distinguish between surrogate endpoints, prognostic factors, and what we might call predictive factors. So a surrogate endpoint is a measurement made on a patient, usually before, during, and after treatment, to determine whether the treatment is working. And so a surrogate endpoint is the kind of thing you could potentially use as the endpoint of a clinical trial to say, is this treatment better than the control treatment or placebo? Better in what way? Well, with regard to some endpoints. So presumably there's some clinical endpoint that really represents real patient benefit. And a lot of times people come up with biochemical or other kinds of measurable endpoints, which they propose as alternative endpoints for evaluating treatments. Most of what I'm talking about today is not about surrogate endpoints. I will say a couple of words about surrogate endpoints, but now the nature of the confusion is when people talk about biomarkers, a lot of times what they're really thinking about are surrogate endpoint biomarkers. But I'm going to use the term biomarker much more generally to mean biological measurement, but I'm not basically going to be talking about surrogate endpoint issues. Then there are prognostic factors. There's, for cancer, I know there's just a huge literature on prognostic factors. Most of this literature is useless. A prognostic factor is generally a measurement made before treatment that correlates with outcome. Very often for a heterogeneous set of patients, and I'll talk a little bit later about why this is not necessarily leads to sort of useful information. Now, that would be distinguished from a predictive factor, which would be a measurement or a biomarker made before treatment to predict whether a particular treatment is likely to be beneficial to that patient. So it's sort of like a prognostic factor, but it's developed with regard to patients who are both appropriate and homogeneous in the sense that they're getting the same treatment and trying to predict who's going to benefit from that treatment, and therefore that kind of a predictive marker could then help you in the future of selecting selecting treatments, appropriate treatments for patients. I'll be using biomarker in the sense, in the general sense, any biological measurement made on a patient. And I'd like to quote Steve Williams of Pfizer. I don't know what clinical validation for biomarker means. The first thing you have to do is define a purpose for the biomarker. Validation is all about demonstrating fitness for the purpose. And I agree strongly with this. So if we're going to use biomarker in a general sense to include both surrogate endpoint and a predictive marker, the kinds of validations that we're going to that are going to be appropriate for a biomarker for as a predictive marker and for selecting treatments or selecting patients are totally different. I have almost nothing to do with the kind of validation that would be appropriate for really validating something you'd use as a surrogate endpoint. So my view is that intermediate endpoints, in other words, things that you might measure other than the ultimate survival or disease-free survival or something that's very directly reduction of pain, something that's a direct measure of benefit to the patient. Intermediate endpoints are useful for phase one and phase two studies. In other words, a lot of times you need some kind of a short-term measurement for determining what dose to go forward with, for determining whether your molecularly targeted drug is really inhibiting the target, for determining what subset of patients seem to be benefiting from that. And you're going to do that in the context of phase one and phase two studies where you're not going to do it with real long-term follow-up in large numbers of patients, particularly for prevention trials. You need, in terms of optimizing and getting your regimen ready for phase three evaluation and deciding whether to go forward, it's very useful to have intermediate endpoints. Those intermediate endpoints don't have to be validated surrogates. And in general, it's going to be impossible to validate the kind of endpoints you use for those purposes. There'll be things that you think are relevant, often things that are necessary but not sufficient for having a long-term benefit of your treatment. And so we need these kinds of things, but we don't necessarily need to validate them in the strong sense that we would need to validate them for to make them real surrogates. It's often more difficult to properly validate an endpoint as a surrogate than it is to actually just use the clinical endpoint in the phase of the trial. So, I mean, there's a whole literature, a lot of it statistical, on what does it mean to validate something for a surrogate endpoint. And I think a lot of it got started with this paper by Ross Prentice about surrogate endpoints in clinical trials and some definitions of validity. And, you know, his definition was that a test of the null hypothesis of no effect on the surrogate outcome S between the treatment and control is a valid test of the null hypothesis of no effect on the true outcome, the true clinical outcome between the treatment and control. And then he went on to say, well, this will be true if these two conditions are true. And then there was a lot of discussion about those conditions. And, you know, for example, Tom Fleming, a quote from Tom Fleming is, one rarely can establish that surrogate endpoints are valid, even in that rare setting in which data on some treatment Z would allow one to view S as a valid surrogate for the true clinical endpoint. One cannot extrapolate this surrogacy to any new treatment, Z star, that could have a mechanisms of action that differ from those of Z. So to really demonstrate that something really is a true surrogate is very difficult. Now, there have been some alternative definitions, and, you know, Prentice's conditions were necessary but not sufficient, and I'm not really going to go on to that, but I think the general situation is that it's difficult to really demonstrate that something is a valid surrogate. My view is that in order to really achieve a lot of the critical path objectives, you don't really need a real surrogate. What you need is a good, what I would call partial surrogate. In other words, improvement of a partial surrogate endpoint being a necessary but not sufficient condition for the approval of the clinical endpoint. And you'd use this partial surrogate the way you already do in phase two trials. They sort of tell you when to hold and when to fold. In other words, you could say, if I'm not getting a treatment effect on this partial surrogate,
then it's unlikely I'm going to be getting my treatment effect on my true clinical outcome, and so I'll cut that pivotal trial short. I won't go to the much enlarged sample size and maybe much longer term follow-up that I will need. And so that will, in itself, reduce the cost of the phase 3 trial. But in the case where I'm really getting a healthy effect on this partial surrogate, then I'm encouraged and it's worthwhile to go on and complete the phase 3 trial, to make it larger, to make the follow-up adequate. And I think the idea that the critical path tries to address is that it wouldn't be so bad if the problem is we're not getting enough really good treatments. And so if there's a lot of candidates that you can test, if it's very expensive to sort of test all of these, then you're only going to be able to test fewer. So this would be a way of being able of reducing the cost of testing, but still, for the ones that are going to have a real benefit, you would wind up demonstrating that benefit with a real clinical endpoint. So I think what we need are sort of good partial surrogates. The other nice thing about a partial surrogate is that those criteria for validation don't apply to partial surrogates, because you would really only be approving something based on the true clinical endpoint. You would just be using the partial surrogate to short-circuit the pivotal trial early. So you really don't need any real validation of it. For it to be effective, you want it to be good, but since you're not basing any approval judgments on it, you don't really need a strict validation.
Rick, I have a question. Do you have any examples for these partial surrogate endpoints? Because I think it's an exciting idea, but about partial responses may be useful for some diseases, but not for other diseases.
I think the experience in cancer is that essentially partial response is the thing that's in the past generally been used.
Tumor response.
Yeah.
And
what we find is,
they're more responsive, but that don't prolong survival. On the other hand,
so there's a lot of drugs that produce partial responses that don't survival improvements. There's a couple of examples where you get a survival improvement, but you don't really get a response. But that's not very wide.
Other drugs are like, I think, Sutent. And actually, that have no increasing response rate and have increasing survival.
See, you could say, in the sense, for the fact that there's a lot of drugs that cause cause response, but don't, at least in phase 2, but don't, in other words, what I'm proposing here is you'd sort of use it in phase 3, where you'd actually have a control group. And so you might actually find the tumor response was a better partial surrogate used this way in phase 3 rather than used in, because usually what happens is you test the drug by itself in phase 2, you find it's active, and then you combine it with some standard combination, and then you compare it to that standard combination in phase 3. And so using tumor response in phase 3 in this way might actually be more effective than just the usual thing. What you're using is just sort of response of the drug as a single agent.
But so you're using it to eliminate the drug, not and decide whether to go on, not to be the basis for the decision.
Exactly.
In the case.
Although there are, as I mentioned, the Sutent drug.
But yes, there's one drug we recently proved that has no response that worked great.
So yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. There are.
That's what
you could have discarded us.
There are some examples of that in that.
Well, except that one doesn't really apply to that example, because there's a targeted therapy, and the paradigm there is that for the leaders in the field, they understand that in their first in human trial for these targeted therapies, they want to have some pharmacodynamic metric that they test in the first in human trial to see if they're hitting it, and they kill the drug if they hit that marker and they don't see any evidence of clinical effect.
Right, but
or if they can't
hit
that marker.
In that case, it would have been a mistake, right?
Yeah. False
or negative. If they they can't hit the marker and there's excessive toxicity. And
yeah, but in this case, it doesn't shrink the tumor. So that's an imperfect response measure. But it's used widely anyway. But it didn't work for that. It doesn't work for
that. You're saying because there wasn't an appreciable tumor response rate in GIST, it would depend on the tumor, because in renal cell carcinoma with that drug, there was a 25 to 35% mm-hmm. tumor response rate. It was in GIST that the response rate was
7%.
Well,
I thought in renal
cell
wasn't.
In a way. No,
renal was 25% as well.
Yeah. Sorry, the first drug, drug A, was taken. You're talking about the second drug. You're talking about Pfizer drug. I'm not. I'm talking about the one you approved 3 months ago on the basis of time to progression with mm-hmm. no response rate.
Yes, that's the one.
That's an imperfect example. You lose a good drug if you use this, but
exactly.
So Rick's not saying.
I'm not arguing for any particular measure. I'm arguing for the concept. I'm saying, the concept is what we should be looking for are good partial surrogates. That's, I think, a very practical. We might be able to accomplish that. You still want it to be good. You don't want it to be false negatives. But you want it to be good. But you don't have to. You're not going to base a regulatory approval on that. And so you don't really have to have any sort of formal validation. Okay, I'm sorry, I did have one slide of prognostic factors. So, again, as I think it's sort of already covered, there's many prognostic factor studies utilize convenient samples of patients that are heterogeneous with regard to disease extent and treatment. And the result, and so you wind up with something is correlated with outcome, but it's also correlated with disease, disease extent, and it's hard to really tell. The reason people do this is because they have these convenient samples in their freezers, and the nicer way to do it is to use for prognostic studies patients for a particular clinical trial. The majority of prognostic factor studies, at least in cancer, are done with very heterogeneous sets of patients, and at the end, it's not really clear that the results are really going to help you in terms of selecting treatments for any patients, and so. Non-therapeutically relevant prognostic factors, they're either published and sort of not used, or if they, in some cases, they actually are used, but they sort of serve to drive up medical costs, because then you have defensive medicine feeling where you've got to do these things, but you don't actually know how to use the answers you get.
So, are we asking questions? Or
sure, yes.
You can use prognostic factors to select a patient population that show an effect in. My favorite example is PSA momentum. If you're doing a study an adjuvant therapy study,
yeah.
You can identify people who have no chance of dying of the tumor.
Yeah, no, you can. That's
in
true.
Contrast to people who have a significant chance, and it's stupid to put the former into the trial because you can't possibly show anything.
I think there are examples like that, but I think there are some examples like that. I think. The mass of the literature winds up not being used, but there are.
Now, if you look at approximately, that's an outcome based approach when you're looking at litigation, and that often is a community based standard as well, rather than being based more on process, so that even if only 10% of there's only a 10% correlation with the abnormal finding with the bad outcome, someone will still use that. If there's an absence of that process, someone will still use that as saying that might have been a prognostic factor for the bad outcome.
You're saying in a legal proceeding? Is that what you're
talking about? that's what you're referring to here, in terms of the
first. Oh, you're talking about the medical, yeah.
Right. So I agree, but the fact is it doesn't matter what percentage, even it can be a very low percentage of relationship between the abnormal laboratory or clinical finding and the bad outcome. But if there is a bad outcome, then only a small percentage results in a bad legal outcome.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what you're saying. You're saying it does not fuel increase.
There is a tremendous amount of interest in how much benefit you get from a treatment, and. But the actual number of people benefit, in treating people with very high systolic pressures versus very low ones. So there's a lot of interest in that. Even if the drug works in everybody, the effect size is much, the actual effect is much bigger in the people with the worst prognosis.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interest in that, especially for expensive treatments.
Okay, so what you're saying is there are examples of use of prognostic factors other than just directly selecting treatments for patients.
Just a follow-up. Are you saying a prognostic factor is a single cohort, absent treatment? These are that's the critical thing. Here, a prognostic factor, as it's traditionally been used in the cardiovascular community, for example, smoking, high cholesterol level and blood pressure are predictive of differentially high or low cardiovascular disease.
No, that's not what I'm
absent
saying.
Treatment.
What I'm saying, in cancer, usually there's no NEF. The usual prognostic factor study, you take patients who have breast cancer, they have no distant metastases, but you collect, your samples include some patients have node-positive disease, node-negative disease, some got cytotoxic chemotherapy, some didn't, some got tamoxifen, some didn't. Some of the tumors were ER positive,
right.
Some were ER negative. For example, this was the microarray study that was done in the Netherlands that led to their classifier was originally done on that kind of a population of patients.
Yeah, but where I was going to the distinction between the prognostic factor, which essentially is a single cohort concept, as opposed to the predictive factors, which is a comparative treatment versus control.
No, that's not the distinction I'm making.
That's not the distinction.
I'm making the distinction here that the predictive factor, you're trying to predict a response to a given treatment. And prognostic, you have a more heterogeneous set of patients.
But a response
heterogeneous with regard to treatment
is inherently a comparative because you have to think about the response being if you were not on treatment and you had that prognostic
for predictive factor. Okay. Ideally it would, but I'm just trying to make the distinction that most of the prognostic factor studies that are done with patients who are heterogeneous with regard to the treatment, the non-clinically clinical trial determined treatments they got, are very difficult to interpret and very difficult to.
A typical example is this retrospective analysis that you always review, that this the new most sexy protein that they assess by immunohistochemistry, and they define that in a retrospective analysis that shows worse prognosis than the rest, and you don't know what to do with that information. And there's tons of those.
Right, but some are well worked out. For example, if you're doing a cardiovascular trial and you want to put people with high C-reactive proteins in it, so there'll be a lot of events, that's perfectly sensible. In aspirin, if you've had a heart attack before, that predicts that you're likely to have a high rate of heart attack, and it's much easier to do a study in those people than in people who've never had one, because you get 10 times as many events.
Even though
have nothing to do with response.
Yeah. I don't know that those. Okay, yeah, there are some. There are some. You're saying that. Well, even there, treatment comes into it somewhat in terms of
maybe not. It can go in the opposite direction. EGFR positivity is a bad prognosis in lung cancer, and it predicts who's going to respond.
Yeah,
it goes the opposite way.
Okay, let's go on because I don't want to spend the whole time on this point. Okay, so now we're going to talk about what I've been calling about predictive factors or trying to do clinical trials so that we find out what works for whom and using biological measurements to select patients for clinical trials. So the conventional wisdom I think that has grown up is that clinical trials should have broad eligibility criteria and basically never believe a subset analysis. And so if you sort of factor these two things in, I think this approach needs reexamination. I mean, where these came from was the idea that treatments that become available will be widely used, and therefore, if you want your phase 3 trial to sort of simulate medical practice, then you should do your phase 3 trials in the way that the drug is eventually going to be used in medical practice, and in which case the idea is it'll probably be widely used, and so your clinical trials should sort of reflect that. So, and of course, the never believed subset analysis came from, in my view, it's really always, it's not been so, it's been a criticism of the way subset analyses have typically been done. Not that the way they had to be done, but that the way they typically were done. In which case, being that you sort of looked, there's no predefined subsets, you use the same data for identifying your subset as for sort of trying to identifying your subset hypothesis as for testing your subset hypothesis. And even in the hands of statisticians, basically doing things sort of in a sloppy manner. There actually have always been tools available for doing subset analyses differently than that, but they basically haven't been used. But so the conventional wisdom, though, has worked out never to believe subset analyses and use broad clinical trials. And I think this, as we learn more about diseases, we really learn more that we need to reevaluate these issues, because in an era where there's increasing evidence that many diseases are really not single diseases at all, they're very heterogeneous with regard to pathogenesis and sensitivity to treatment, and even calling them a disease, I think is sort of questionable. So, broad eligibility may cause basically large clinical trials that fail to establish the effectiveness of useful drugs, or inconsistency in the results among different randomized clinical trials because they sort of reflect different distributions of the subsets of patients who actually do benefit from the drug. Post-approval treatment of many patients who don't actually benefit, because there's actually maybe a subset of patients who really benefit, the drug winds up getting approved without really identifying what that subset is in broad clinical trials. And so the drug then is widely used, and it has a average benefit for the population that it's used in, but that benefit may be small. And yet the drug, all of the patients are then subject to the risks of side effects from the drug and the expense of that drug. For example, here's an example, I guess, with this is an NSABP, an early NSABP trial, I think it was B20. These were node negative women with primary breast cancer, no distant metastases, who were had estrogen receptor positive tumors, comparing tamoxifen alone to tamoxifen plus methotrexate and fluorouracil, or CMF chemotherapy. And for example, this was tamoxifen alone. These were the two arms that contained cytotoxic chemotherapy in addition to tamoxifen. And these are the three different endpoints: disease-free survival, distant disease-free survival, and survival. You get very highly significant effects, leading to the conclusion that yes, node-negative women, ER-positive women, at least the kind that were eligible for this trial, should get chemotherapy. But if you actually then look at the axes, you see this was from the original publication, so it had 5-year follow-up at that time. This is, 85% at 5 years, and this is maybe 90% at 5 years. So you wind up with a conclusion. So 85% of the patients, I don't know where this is going to plateau, but it's probably going to plateau. I think it plateaus somewhere above 80%. So a large proportion of these women are probably cured by surgery and radiation alone. You have a 5 percentage, 5% of the patients maybe benefit from chemotherapy, and then you wind up with the conclusion that these women should get chemotherapy. So what it says is that most of them who get chemotherapy aren't going to benefit at all. So in cancer clinical trials of molecularly targeted agents may benefit. Some of them, not always true, but some of them may benefit a relatively small population of patients with a given primary site and stage of disease. The RESA looks like it probably benefits a small percentage of patients, whether those are patients who have mutations in the EGFR gene or whether they probably includes patients who have amplification of that gene, but probably does not include all of lung cancer patients or even half of them. Herceptin, basically about a third of patients are HER2 positive. And the benefit for the sensitive subset may be very, very substantial, larger than what we're used to seeing, but and that the overall treatment effect may be, however, driven by a subset. So targeted clinical trials can be much more efficient than untargeted clinical trials if we know who to target. I generally like the word targeted, not enriched, because I like that for a given clinical, enriched suggests to me that you have some population and you're just going to enrich it with a larger percent of some other population. And to me, that suggests sort of an artificial mixing that is going to be very difficult to then generalize a result and to know who the results apply to. Whereas either if you think of it more as just sort of unselected and representing, you know, patients with those kind of eligibility criteria, that's one thing. Or if you target patients who have a specific biomarker, classifier positive, something like that, but then I know what that means. But the enriched business always leaves me uncomfortable because how do you generalize the results of that to what, to who?
You have two purposes to enrichment. One is to be able to show something.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
That's a useful purpose, though.
I think it's only a useful purpose if you know what to do once you've shown it.
No, it's useful anyway.
Okay.
It's not as useful. I totally agree.
But I'm not sure it's useful.
It's more efficient in terms of trial design. Really, you're both right. Enrichment means you're going to have a higher frequency of events of interest. You need less patients to show an effect. And targeted means you're looking at a specific group of people with certain characteristics. You guys agree.
I think we do.
It's more semantic.
But Rich, going, for example, you showed the breast cancer thing.
Uh-huh.
If you took those people and did that SNP array that I guess the Dutch people...
It's not SNP, these are expression profiles.
Okay, but there is a 71 or whatever it is now, SNP
those,
array.
That's gene expression, it's not genotype.
Okay, whatever it is,
yeah.
You can define people who are more and less likely to have distant metastases, even though they all look exactly the same. So if you're doing the trial you showed there and you chose people for it who were likely to have distant metastases, that would be, it might tell you about doing treatment, but it also represents your only possibility of showing a survival effect.
No,
what
I'm saying is, that is targeting. What I'm calling that, maybe what he's saying is right, we're not disagreeing. I'm calling that targeting because you're using a particular classifier to select your patients. And so then I know who those results apply to. What I'm saying is if I just sort of say, well, the trial is going to be open to everybody, whether you have positive or negative, but I'm just going to go out and try to get more patients who are like this, who are classifier positive than classifier negative, then it becomes a little bit more difficult.
We can talk about this later. One of the great problems for us is how much data you need on the untargeted group to show that it really doesn't work at all.
Right.
So that comes up.
But I also concur with Rich said about this unsureness about the use of the word enrichment in cases where you can try to increase the number of events for the enrichment purpose. That's what Dr. Temple has been talking about. However, in other cases, company may come in and talk about that I want to enrich only a certain percent rather than the entire enrichment of the entire trial. So that can be confusing.
Obviously, generalization results, though, are very important. And a lot of people dismiss clinical trials because they don't think they apply to their patients. And so, you know, obviously, it's important. Not, you know, if you're sort of doing clinical trials on high-risk subsets of patients, that's fine, but then your results should apply to high-risk subset of patients. If you're doing clinical trials on sort of mixed groups that you've sort of artificially included more high-risk, but you also have low-risk, then you don't know what to include, what to conclude from a positive trial.
But you might. You can identify your primary hypothesis as being in the higher-risk people and get information on the lower-risk people. That's informative.
I think you sort of wind up, what you wind up doing then is wind up doing a lot of subset analyses that you may not be very interpretable.
But you planned it.
Well, if you're going to plan it, then you're going to have to increase your sample size to studying those subsets. And I think you sort of build this, well, you should do this and you should do that. You sort of build a structure that's not doable to a large extent. I don't think it's necessary to do things that way. So adoption of a classifier. I'd like to make a certain distinction. Adoption of a classifier to restrict the use of treatment in wide use. In other words, if you have a treatment that's already in wide use and you're trying to say, well, who does this treatment really benefit? That then you're not talking about. You should have studies demonstrating that the use of the classifier has clinical utility compared to making a treatment assignment without using the classifier. But I think I'm trying to make a point that's a different situation than with a new drug development where you're trying to use a classifier to identify a target patient population to develop your drug in. In one case, you already have a drug or a treatment in wide use, and you're trying to say, well, now I'm thinking of putting into use some kind of a diagnostic. And so you should have to basically demonstrate something about clinical utility of that diagnostic. Here, you sort of have a package. You've got, you're developing, you have a diagnostic and you have a drug, and you're potentially going to use that diagnostic to tell you which patients you want to study. And so the question then becomes, so the purpose of the classifier is to select a target population for treatment. And so I think the focus should be on evaluating the new drug, not on evaluating the diagnostic. But the diagnostic, its main purpose, now in some cases it would be nice to be able to do both, but to be able to do both is a more ambitious goal. But if you can use this diagnostic to identify a set of patients for which that drug works, then the question is, well, if you really wanted to establish clinical utility of that diagnostic, you would have to show that the drug doesn't work for everybody, you know, who could have been selected without the use of the diagnostic. And in some situations, it becomes difficult to treat the diagnostic negative.
But you're happy. Well,
we're going to talk about this more.
The selected people and have no.
Like I said, we're going to get into this more, so don't worry. I'm going to leave this point. So here's developmental strategy one. So developmental strategy one is essentially where you have some kind of a diagnostic classifier, and you're just going to study the positives. So you develop a diagnostic classifier, and we're not going to go into much how you develop it. You know, we're talking about how you use it or validate it. You're going to develop a diagnostic classifier based either on phase one and phase two data or whatever that identifies the patients likely to benefit from the new drug. And you develop some reproducible assay for being able to read this classifier. And then you use the diagnostic to restrict eligibility to a new prospectively planned evaluation of this new drug. And you demonstrate that the new drug is effective in this prospectively defined set of patients determined by the diagnostic. So, like this, you somehow develop some predictor of response to the new drug, and then you just do a clinical trial of the new drug versus control in patients who were classifier positive, predictor to be responsive. You don't do it in this other. You have either, and this would be basically the situation where you have the diagnostic is so tied to the molecular target of the drug that you don't really want to study in these patients, because you basically have no reason to believe it's going to work in these patients. Tamoxifen, do you really want to study tamoxifen in ER-negative patients? Do you really, with Herceptin, the original studies of Herceptin were not in Herceptin, in HER2-negative patients. So, but I published a couple of papers with one of my postdocs evaluating the efficiency of that kind of targeted randomized clinical trial compared to the clinical trial where you wouldn't use the diagnostic. You would, say, just randomize all the patients with that staged primary time.
On that point, do you have some thoughts about the big problem of the development of the classifier from the minimal data set, if you will, that sort of establishes some sensitivity and specificity of that classifier?
Well, if I try to get into that, I'm afraid I won't.
All right, okay. All right.
Maybe deal with that.
But there are two issues and things regarding that, is that you have to be sure that the test really reflects what's going on.
I think doing it this way.
And the other issue is that there are drugs that you believe that the target is X, but maybe there are other targets that you don't know.
Absolutely right.
And there is evidence
could be
that
wrong.
So
I'm not saying you should always do it this way. Okay. I'm saying it's one way you can do it, and I think it's probably the only time you do it is where you really have strong biological data that you know what's going on. And so basically we did this sort of statistical study of comparing this targeted design to the untargeted design with regard to the number of patients required to achieve statistical significance with a fixed power, and the number of patients you'd need to screen, because if you're doing the targeted design, not everybody's going to be classifier positive, so you're going to have to screen a larger number of patients to get whatever number you need to randomize. This is a table that actually wasn't in either of those publications, because this is some subsequent simulations we did with time to events rather than binary response or sort of normally distributed response. But for example, this column is what is the treatment effect for the marker positive patients? Is it a halving of the hazard of the event, or is it a one-third reduction in the hazard of the event? And so if you do the targeted design, how many events do you need to observe to get, I think it was 5% two-sided significance for a 90% power, I think it was, for, say, this halving. And it's to detect a halving in the targeted design, you need a total of 74 events. And to detect a one-third reduction in the hazard, you need a total of 200 events, approximately. And so if you did a traditional design, unselected, how many events would it take to get the power that you need? And now you're going to have a sort of a diluted treatment effect, because you're studying patients for whom there's really a treatment effect intermixed with patients for whom they're not, and so it depends on what percentage of the patients are actually marker positive, and so if it's 33%, you're going to need like 720 events for a third of the patients are marker positive. Now this sort of probably overstates somewhat the size of the benefit in reduction in sample size, because it's really for a situation where there's totally no treatment effect in the marker negative patients. And that's, in many cases, that may not be the case, or it may be that your assay, your marker is not perfect. And so even if there is some subset of patients for whom that's who the treatment works for and it doesn't work for anybody else, your particular assay may not be perfect in sort of diagnosing those patients. So
the Tarceva data we have with breast cancer certainly makes it look like there's little or no benefit.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, in that kind of a situation, which would be...
And this might be true for Herceptin.
Yeah, right. And so this is the Herceptin situation. I mean, subsequently we've had phase 3 trials in early breast cancer, and Herceptin is about a third of the patients are HER2 positive. Herceptin, these multiple large phase 3 trials in HER2 positive patients have produced whopping effects on disease-free survival, which is bigger than we've just ever seen before. And so...
And as adjuvant therapy, too.
Yeah, that's adjuvant situation.
You're talking about classifiers that are really tied to the target, and such as that. Now we're gonna. I think I'm gonna skip this. This is just sort of some stuff from the paper that deals with. This was the clinical cancer research paper that dealt with binding. But it shows that
you're right in that way.
Well, it shows that even if outside of the subset, if the marker negative patients have half the treatment effect as the marker positive patients, you can still get you can require about twice or more as many patients with an untargeted design as with a targeted design. You may have to screen more patients to get that number, but so Herceptin, of course, is an example of where targeting really works well, and even though the original HER2 assay was not a good assay, it still was very effective in terms of making that development practical and effective. So generally, one should require, I think, that the classer as a whole be reproducibly measurable, and as a whole, the classifier in conjunction with the new drug has clinical utility. Demonstrating that the classifier, or if we're talking about like a gene expression classifier, any of its components are validated biomarkers of disease status should not be a requirement, because those validated biomarkers of disease status, those kinds of criteria really should apply as surrogate endpoint biomarkers, not biomarkers for selecting patients for treatment. You know, really, we talk about fit for a purpose. Well, the purpose here is for selecting patients for treatment. So we should be, for these kind of biomarkers, we should be showing that, yes, they're useful in selecting patients for a particular treatment. Ensuring that the individual components of the classifier are correlated with the patient outcome or effective. In other words, if we have some gene expression based classifier that involves a bunch of genes, we really want to evaluate that classifier as a whole. In developing the classifier, we'll look at the individual components and try to put components in there that seem to be effective. But when it comes time to the point of the validation stage, or we don't want to really go back and look at the individual components. And demonstrating that repeating the classifier development process on independent data results in the selection of the same components, this is not what I'm calling validation. This is, I feel like there's a lot of misstatements in the literature about this group got this classifier with these genes in predicting risk of outcome, and some other group got a different set of genes, and there wasn't much overlap between the two sets of genes, and therefore the whole system is garbage. That's, I think, erroneous thinking. In other words, if the first group got a classifier that
based on a certain number of genes, and then the second group had another set of data. The real question is, how did the first group's classifier, how effective was it on the other group's set of data in classifying those patients? Was the first classifier accurate in classifying the second, the independent patients with regard to whether they had good outcome or bad outcome? Not whether, if you repeat the process, you wind up with the same set of genes. There's lots of statistical reasons why you're not going to wind up with the same set of genes. And there's other reasons if you're doing different platforms. I think that there's just a lot of fuzzy thinking and misguided thinking and over skepticism and over criticism based on a misunderstanding of what validation really is when we're talking about predictive models or classifiers. So developmental strategy 2 is shown here, where basically you develop some predictor of response to a new treatment, where you think it's predicting the patients who are going to be responsive to the treatment. But either you don't have such great confidence in it, either because you recognize you might not really know what the real target of the drug is, or because it's an empirically determined kind of thing. You know, it's a gene expression profile based classifier that is not really biologically tied to the target. And so you don't have tremendous concern in it, and even if you have tremendous confidence in it, or basically you'd like to have a sort of a broader labeling indication anyway, and so you're hoping that maybe there is sort of a broader degree of activity in your, and a lot of times if you're developing this classifier based on phase 2 data, and certainly if it's an empirically determined kind of thing, you're not going to have tremendous confidence in it, because you didn't have all that much data to develop it with. So I think you'll be in this situation a lot. And so basically you do your trial, a new treatment versus control, both in the classifier positive and the classifier negative patients. But what I think is crucial is that you write this protocol having a very detailed analysis plan of how you're going to use this classifier in the analysis of the data. Not that you're going to say, I'm going to stratify, because that doesn't mean anything. Stratify, what does it mean? You're going to stratify the randomization? That doesn't tell me anything about how you're going to analyze the data. I don't care what you stratify. Stratifying the randomization, all that tells me is that you're only going to accept patients for treatment if they have the classifier measured at the time they go on to treatment. Now, that may be useful. That forces you to make sure that everybody has a specimen available and that it's, you're not going to have missing data for anybody, because if you require that for stratification, it means they can't get into the trial. But that's the only value to me of stratification. Stratification is not a substitute for an analysis. It's not an analysis plan. It's not a substitute for an analysis plan. It doesn't tell you whether you're going to split the alpha, whether this is really two clinical trials, whether you're going to size the trial so as to have adequate power separately for this as for this, and whether you're going to have separate alphas for these two. It doesn't tell you any of that stuff. It just sort of sweeps it all under the rug of a meaningless term, stratification. So what I'm saying is, in a lot of cases this will be your design, but you really need to write into the protocol exactly what your analysis plan is.
Are you going to get into quantitative aspects of this?
I've thought a lot about quantitative aspects of this, but I'm not going to talk a lot about it today.
Okay, let me.
I will have one slide about it.
This comes up all the time.
Okay.
Every time somebody has a classifier or a predictor, and the question always is, how much do you have to know about that right-hand group?
Okay.
If the effect size is modestly smaller, well, you already know you're not going to be able to say anything definitive about it in a reasonable sample size, because you're not going to have enough people. I mean, if the hazard ratio is 0.5 for the people who are the right ones and 0.3 for the others, you're not going to be able to rule it in or out, probably.
Well, here's the analysis. I'm actually proposing, in this case, a particular analysis plan.
Okay.
Which isn't necessarily the only analysis plan, but I'm proposing a specific analysis plan. The analysis plan I'm proposing is, you don't use the diagnostic, the classifier, to restrict eligibility, but to structure a prospective analysis plan. The analysis plan I'm proposing is the following. You compare the new drug to the control overall for all patients, ignoring the classifier. And you do that comparison, treatment versus control, with a threshold of 0.04 p-value. And if your overall p-value, comparing treatment to control, is less than 0.04, you claim effectiveness for the eligible patients as a whole. Okay? And if you don't, and only if you don't, you perform a single subset analysis evaluating new drug versus control in the classifier positive patients. And you do that comparison at a p of 0.01 threshold. And if that p is less than 0.01, then you claim effectiveness for the classifier in the positive patients. If it's not, you don't claim effectiveness for the classifier in anybody. And so this is what I'm proposing as, and of course you could dream up other ones, but that's...
Why can't you do both right off the bat?
Because if you do both off of the bat, then you don't... See, this is not only an analysis plan, it's sort of a decision structure. And if you do both, you're sort of saying, yeah, you can do whatever you want, but then you don't know what to decide.
But you don't know what to decide here.
I do, because I'm building it in here.
No, you don't. Suppose the whole effect is driven by the subset.
The whole effect may be driven by the subset, but I'm saying the reason I want to do it this way is because I want to build in an incentive for sponsors to be able to even develop the classifier. And I want them to be able to say, I'm going to go ahead and develop this classifier and measure it and get tumor specimens, if you're talking about cancer, and I'm going to be able to do, the only thing that's going to be, I'm going to be willing to do that for two reasons. One, it's, I feel some confidence that it's not going to come and bite me, because I'm still going to be able to do the analysis in the traditional way. And if I get an overall effect, then I will not have been hurt by having done that. And what this design gives me is sort of a second shot at it. If my traditional analysis is not significant, if I start saying sort of what you're saying, Bob, I'm going to look at the negatives and I'm going to look at the positives, and then if I were a company, I wouldn't even develop the classifier often.
But let's take a living, breathing example. This is all post facto because they didn't know it going in. But Herceptin clearly wins overall. Okay? But
Herceptin, what do you mean?
Herceptin was wrong. Tarceva.
Nice.
Clearly wins overall. That's how they did the study.
Right.
But when you break it down, not in everybody, but in the third of the patients who had EGFR status, there is no hint of an effect in the EGFR negative people. It actually slightly leans the wrong way, but the confidence is a little wide, so you can't say for sure. The effect seems to be entirely and very large in the EGFR positive patients. So if we had all these data, all in anticipation, and got a result like that, where it looks as if you're paying $100,000 a patient for nothing, I don't think we'd be so happy.
Yeah. Well,
even if they didn't.
I guess I'm sort of, what I'm trying to identify is the trade-offs. I'm concerned that otherwise, you can do voluntary submissions all you want, but when it actually comes down to developing the drug, I think a lot of companies are not, you know, going to want to get involved with measuring.
But there is another incentive, which is that even if you don't win overall, you can still win in the subset. That's not such a bad thing for a company.
Okay. Anyway, well, that's okay. I've sort of just identified what's.
Ask a question.
Yeah.
Can ask a question. I think, Richard, you can go one step further. Use the gatekeeper methodology also to test the subset which has a classifier negative.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm proposing.
Because I think it's also.
Okay. Well, here's what I'm saying. if you want to test the classifier positives and the classifier negatives separately, then I believe statistically you probably should size it appropriately. That leads to actually much larger clinical trial, and so now you're saying, well, if I'm going to develop this classifier, means now I've got to, if I really want to do this and give myself the chance, now I've got to double the size of my clinical trial. You're building in all kinds of disincentives to study. To study pharmacogenomics.
But clinicians would be worried if the drug is not working in some sense.
This is the way we always do the studies.
But you can have a confirmation trial in that particular subset.
Oh, wow.
And then if it wins, then you.
I mean, the original Herceptin trial was not done in the HER2 negatives. So.
But there was a reason. It was toxic. It caused heart failure.
Yeah.
They really didn't want to treat people.
Well, I don't know. I guess my concern is that you are actually building in lots of disincentives to study genomics.
Gives you two ways to win. That's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing, but is it worth doubling the size of your trial?
Richard, before you leave that slide, I'm a non-statistician. But I have a question, and I understand all reservations you have about moving too far away from this. But if we look at it exclusively statistically, is this generalizable in that you split the P as a sum? Could you have done the same thing, and I know you're hesitant to, with 0.03 and 0.03?
Yeah, right, it would have been the same thing.
Thank you.
Okay. We won't go into how you size this trial, but you could size it either for the overall test at 0.04 or for a subset test, or you could make it a two-stage thing for the overall test at 0.04, and if that is not rejected, then you continue accrual to the subset if the overall test is not significant. But we won't go into that. So the key features are the purpose of the clinical trial, and regardless of, I think, whether even the, some alternative sort of analysis plans of the kind that you know, I think sounds like appeal to you more. I think some of these comments apply equally to those two. The purpose of the trial is to sort of evaluate the treatment versus control, overall or and for the predefined subset or for the positives and the negative subsets, not to reevaluate the components of the classifier. Or to modify or refine the classifier. I feel like this is critical, and it's not part of the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom is, well, now I'm going to do this phase 3 trial, and what the phase 3 trial means is now I'm going to have a whole lot more data to sort of build a classifier. No, that's if you want to have a lot more data to build a classifier, if you want this phase 3 trial to be your database for building the classifier, then now you need some additional phase 3 trial to evaluate that classifier. So the idea here is so this is a key point. So this is not an opportunity to sort of start redefining or refining your classifier. We're talking about predefined subset. If you do that, you're sort of back into traditional subset analysis is what you really are.
Does this apply to any classifier that comes from outside of the study? Typical example, two studies going concurrently. One comes out negative. The other one's ongoing. They go and look at one study, find out something interesting. Want to use that now.
Yes,
as a
that
prospective
would be fine.
Classifier, you go into the other study,
exactly.
And you take your chances.
Yeah, I have that in a subsequent slide.
And you split
slide.
It.
Yeah.
That's what. You
yeah.
think that's okay?
Right. Yeah.
Well, they might not even split it. They might devote the whole 0.05 to the subset.
You could.
Well, that's the roll of the dice.
You could.
Yeah.
I mean, I had
the other one's
yes.
very convincing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in other words, and that's actually a nice way to come up with your classifier because you have a lot more data than you will for your typical phase 1 and phase 2 trial.
And this analysis is done at the design stage. Would you go power your study initially to test for that alpha, and consequently, would you put in your patient population the two group, and would you determine what's the mix-up for the general population, where you have less than 1,000 people living there. I'd like to know in the design stage.
How would you size the study? Yeah, okay. You could either size it for the way I propose it, you could either size it just for the overall test at the 0.04 level, which would not leave you very good power for the subset test, and you'd only probably get a positive subset treatment effect within the subset if it was a very large effect. Or you could actually size the whole trial based on some subset test. Or you could sort of say, well, I'm going to make it a two-stage trial, and the first stage will be sized for this overall thing, and then if I go on.
But in terms of sizing it for the overall test at the 0.04, would you go to involve what are the ratio of those people who have positive classifier when you put in the trial versus those who are negative? Because I assume if the overall test at the 0.04 will be impacted by the proportion who are positive classifier versus those who are negative, and consequently the mix-up between those
you could groups. You could. That might be reasonable to do.
You could also, not to use the words you don't like, have more than the ordinary fraction of people in the subset. You could decide that the subset's going to be half of the population.
I wouldn't like
if
that.
If it's a baseline characteristic.
That's the point.
Suppose the people with the
relevant... Then I would really worry about the generalizability.
Oh, it's generalizable to the people you study. Suppose the fraction of people is only 3% or 5%.
Fraction of people who are positive?
Yeah. Then you don't have a chance.
Oh, okay.
So you might decide to put it... I mean, I'm asking this because we're dealing with...
Yeah, okay, no, you're right, you're right.
It's very big.
Yeah, right. I think then... then you have to be... Yeah, if you do an enrichment kind of thing like that, I think then... Well, then you're almost thrown into the having to analyze the positives and negatives separately.
Yeah, and you get some data on the negatives, which is better than nothing, but most of your data is on the people you think are going to respond.
So the other point is there will be opportunity... with this kind of a design, to examine whether the treatment is effective in the classified negative patients. In some cases, you know, as we said, there'll be strong biological justification for testing the treatment only in classifier positive patients. So the key features are a pre-specified analysis plan, single predefined subset, the overall type 1 error is split between the overall test and the subset test, and I've already talked about the stratification issue. So the idea, the general kind of idea of what I'm proposing is you develop a completely specified genomic classifier of the patients likely to benefit, you establish reproducibility of measuring that classifier, and then you use the classifier to design and analyze a new clinical trial to evaluate the effectiveness of your treatment. With a pre-designed, defined analysis plan. Not, you don't design a new clinical trial to sort of refine your classifier.
Can I ask about defining that threshold between classifier positive and classifier negative?
Well, we actually are, Boris Friedman and I and one of our postdocs are working on that.
We're
dealing right now with a situation where we're studying where you have a defined classifier, but you don't know what's the right threshold. And so we're trying to see whether you can use that phase 3 trial to both define the threshold and evaluate treatments with it.
Question. Do you see the whole result of the clinical trial will be dependent on the mix-up of your population? So if I have a very small proportion of those who have positive classifier, I might end up missing the whole treatment.
Right.
So consequently, this is why I think behind my question in the beginning, would you specify a certain proportion, which I think to be
I think in that situation, in other words, you're saying, you're saying that's what Bob was saying.
Enrich.
You want to enrich the population. And I think all I'm saying is in that situation, the overall test becomes the overall test becomes of less interest.
That's right.
And I assume the enrichment will be dependent on the treatment size for the two subgroups.
You mean as to how much you should enrich for?
Yeah,
well, I mean, I think in that sort of situation, you're going to want to evaluate the treatment in the positives and separately in the negatives, and so you probably ought to size it for being able to do both of those things. So the guiding principle, and again, you know, a lot of these things, when you hear them, they sound, well, why are you wasting my time with these obvious statements? But if you realize that the conventional wisdom is how we... These guiding principles are not principles that we're following in our conventional wisdom. Like, the data used to develop a classifier must be distinct from the data used to test hypotheses about treatment effects and subsets determined. Sounds obvious, but when I sort of say, well, the purpose of the clinical trial is not to refine and reevaluate the classifier, well, if you do that, then you're violating this principle. If you start refining and reevaluating your classifier, yeah, you can do it, but now you need another phase 3 clinical trial. So, but this is the guiding principle. Now, in the case of where that you just asked about, I think is an important sort of case where, well, what if you just have one parameter, a threshold? Can you actually use in some clever way the same set of data for refining that and also still evaluating the treatment within the subset. So developmental studies are exploratory. I really haven't talked at all today to give a totally separate talk about developing classifiers. But we could talk about that. They're exploratory, but I'm trying to make the distinction. The studies on which we treatment effectiveness claims are to be based should be the kind of studies we know all about how to do, basically. You know, everybody in this room, we've been doing clinical trials for years. We have good principles of how to do clinical trials. And basically, you define your hypotheses in advance, you define your patient populations in advance, and you test some hypothesis about treatment effect in a defined population. And the only thing that genomics has to do with it is we're using genomics to develop a classifier to specify the population. End of story. Everything other than that is all of the good principles that we know about clinical trials. Yeah.
Do you think there's any way you could do the awful thing that you're talking about? For example, we've talked about this. Suppose you looked at the first
sure.
third of the population and did some genomic.
Yeah, well, that's what we published a paper on that. Yeah.
Your way is clear. The way I'm going to ask you is not as clear. You did it in the third and it predicted very well. Then you take the second third of the data and use the same classifier and it predicts very well too. This is all after the fact. Then you do this, and this is after the study's over. Then you do the last third of the study, and it still predicts. Is there any weight where that would ever be credible?
When you say it predicts, what do you mean it predicts?
It turns out that you get a good response in the people who had some genomic classifier, but not in the overall population. I'm talking about retrospective subsets, and the question is, could they ever be credible?
Well, I mean,
like if you did the first third, then the replicated.
I mean, it's very similar
third.
To what we did in our clinical cancer research. The idea is you
did it prospectively, though, and that's clean.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking after the study's over. You wouldn't buy doing it once because you know.
No, I don't know. That's of course a judgment call. I think what we should be doing is trying to get to the point where we are saying very clearly. You should write this into your analysis plan. You should write into your analysis plan that, okay, you don't have a classifier, but you still want to do this kind of stuff. So what you should write into your analysis plan is you're going to take the first third or the first half of the patients, and you're going to develop a classifier. And then at the end of the trial, you're going to do one analysis would be the kind I talk about. You're going to just compare your treated to your control overall, ignoring the classifier. You're going to have an alpha of 0.04 or something. And then for the other half, and then you're also going to use that last 0.01 to just test the treatment effect in the classifier, positive patients, excluding the patients that you use. In other words, just
we really should be getting people. Now, whether what you do when you actually have in the real world a clinical trial where it wasn't in the analysis plan, I don't know. You know, it's you know, it's the old thing that there are degrees of you know, it's not black and white. There are degrees.
Right.
But I think if we are really clear, and particularly not we, but the FDA is really clear in terms of practical things that you really want, and analysis plans that sample analysis plans that would be attractive, maybe not the only ones, but they would be that sponsors could see. Then I think we'd be less likely to wind up in this situation where we have to use these subjective judgments, because we would have more situations where people actually did put it into their analysis. But when we have guidelines for co-development and biomarkers that are very general, then I think we don't wind up with specific analysis plans.
A question on, and you've thought about this in the sort of the Bayesian versus the frequentist world. What you're doing here is controlling a type 1 error in the subgroup of the classifier positives. It's likely to be a relatively small percentage of the overall population. So the question is, what's the probability that it's a true positive, given the prior that you might have? And so you're obviously going to have a wide confidence interval on the subset.
Yeah. I wouldn't use any of that stuff. You know, it all comes down to who's prior, you know.
I'm not trying to bring the the Bayesian prior in. What I'm sort of saying is most folks will say all you've done is controlled the false positive,
yeah.
Right? Is it likely a true positive? And you got a small amount of data. And one way of thinking about that is go do another trial where you've shown me that the same thing holds. So it's the issue of sort of confirmation of the effect, the replication of the effect. A single study only takes you so far.
Right. I've always been a believer in confirmatory studies. So, I mean, I like confirmation too.
Confirmation.
So. Use of archived samples, I think, archived samples from a conventional, non-targeted, negative clinical trial can be used to define a binary classifier. I think this is an example you asked about, of a subset thought to benefit from a treatment relative to control. That subset hypothesis could be tested in a separate clinical trial, which could be a prospective targeted type 1, what I call type 1 clinical trial, or a prospective type 2 clinical trial, or, as you suggested, analysis of archived specimens from a second previously conducted clinical trial to identify the classifier positive patients, where you've developed that classifier not on that clinical trial, but on this other.
So you'd feel moderately comfortable.
Yes,
with
I
that.
Would. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's different.
Yeah. Well, I think the two scenarios differ, though. What Dr. Simon is talking about is that they develop this classifier in a separate study and then use another retrospective study to confirm that effect. But the example Temple mentioned was using the first a third of the data to develop the classifier, and then use the second third and the third third to validate that. So he's talking about
no,
I mean, I think
that's not
talking
so
about
different
separate.
From
yeah, no,
the third,
I wasn't meaning to say that I disagreed with, you know, with doing that. I don't know that I would do first, third, second, third, third, because you wind up slicing it too thin.
Right.
I might just
why not?
Right, that's the
but
difference.
It's the same
yeah.
idea.
No, I think
that
it's
it
fine.
Is actually
yeah.
a second
yeah. no,
study
I don't
done
have.
Entirely retrospectively.
Yeah. I think it's okay.
But confirmed in a second.
Yeah.
Yes,
do you have any thoughts about whether this has to be sort of biologically based classifier? I mean, we've seen this done in males versus females. One study is negative, they go in, looks like it works in females. Want to go back in, and if you use this philosophy as a general philosophy.
I think the thing you have to be careful, I mean, I think we're always most comfortable where we have some, where the diagnostic classifier, what we're calling the diagnostic classifier, has some biological basis. You know, it's linked to the molecular target or whatever. But in general, I don't think it has to be. But I think the only thing I don't would be very uncomfortable about is you don't want a situation where the people have hit this independent set of data with a whole bunch of different classifiers, and then just present to you with the one that. So I like it prospective in that I know that this is not the 15th time they've analyzed
well,
this.
Well, in theory, you probably the negative study is going to be milked for as much as it's worth.
The negative study is okay.
And whatever comes out of that milking then would be a one-shot deal going
that's
into the
right.
second
that's
study.
That's fine. Yeah, that's fine. In fact, the reason, you know, I've been in studies for developing, you know, where we were going to do a split sample thing, and you know, people would say, well, why didn't you do some kind of a cross-validation? And in some cases, cross-validation is often more efficient in the use of the data, but if the advantage of the split sample is that you can squeeze and try all kinds of things on your training sample, and you can look at biological interpretability. But what you really want to do, I don't actually care what you do on how you develop your classifier on that training sample. But what I do care strongly about is that you come out of there with one completely defined, totally defined classifier, and you only come out of there with that one classifier once.
That's not quite a confirmatory study, though. If the initial analysis looked at everything under the sun.
No, the initial analysis. Why?
Well, it's a single study has the error rate of a single study. It's not like you've done it.
Oh no, no! But I'm saying you don't claim anything about this initial study other than the fact that it was negative and it gave rise to this classifier.
Right. But that's my point. This is not as we worry about this. This is not two studies.
No, no.
It's really
I don't view that the initial study that developed the classifier
has any confirmatory value.
Yeah,
at all.
Yeah,
so you've gotten one study.
Right,
now
that's just a developmental study.
But I guess the other question is back to your prospective analysis plan, which you sort of commit to at the initial part of the stage of the second study, confirmatory study. Do you have any constraints on when during the course of that study you're allowed to sort of jump in on this magic subgroup?
I really haven't thought about that.
This is a big time issue.
Yeah.
Because there's a trust issue going on.
Sure, yeah. No, I
think and we see this a lot where they throw the seeds to the wind, have two or three studies, they turn out to be negative, they milk them, and then they come back in on the third one and essentially are 80% through the trial, haven't broken the blind yet, and then say, I want to go in and look at this subgroup. And we're saying, this doesn't smell right. This is a little too late in the game.
Well, why?
Well, that's why I'm asking you.
Okay, the only thing I want to make sure about is that they haven't already looked at this second study.
Really blind.
Other than that, I don't think it.
Well, we get nervous about how good the firewall was.
Yeah, right.
I have a question to this discussion before because I find it interesting from the perspective of looking at the drug versus the actual classifier, because I think that's the real issue. I mean, all we talk about here are the statistical sort of shadow zones of not really knowing what the actual result is, because only then these theories are critical. If you get a whopping response, it doesn't really matter.
What do you mean?
So what I'm saying is if the effect in your subgroup or overall is so large that you just see the result that it's obvious, you don't have to go in these very detailed
analysis. If we know from a long history that if you take one clinical trial and you look at lots and lots of subsets, you will find some subset that has a whopping treatment effect and that is totally not credible.
I certainly agree with this, but I guess my point is the
So what I'm saying is, you know, in other words, it's this principle that the development of the classifier that defines a subset be in a separate set of data than you go to evaluate it, I think that's a key principle. And the fact that you have one clinical trial and that you can find some subset in that clinical trial for which it looks like there's a whopping treatment effect, that's just old-fashioned garbage subset analysis.
We're running a little late.
So we have an overall.
Yeah, that was not my point.
Okay.
My point was, if you do what Bob suggested before, with a third year, then you sort of avoid, you can avoid that problem. And the question is how you benefit from a trial size that is large enough to allow you this in the first place, so you don't have to go back into another large trial.
The
point I'm making is that it's perhaps not your drug, but the classifier that you need to pay more attention to.
Oh, well, no, I'm not saying that it's not important to pay attention to the classifier. And in fact, for these designs to work effectively, you want to have a good classifier. And so I'm not saying that the I'm just saying I can't do everything, you know, in one talk, and so I'm not focusing on that.
We need to move on.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to skip some of these. For expression profiling for settings where you don't really know how to identify patients likely to be responsive to the new treatment based on its mechanism of action, only pre-treatment specimens are needed. A lot of people don't realize that. Expression profiling should be used to identify informative genes and form a binary classifier that can be used to select patients for study of predefined subset analysis. A set of genes is not a classifier. There's selecting the genes, selecting some mathematical way of combining the expression levels for the genes, determining the weights and other parameters and cutoffs, thresholds to be used with the classifier. All of that goes into the classifier. There should be no requirement for demonstrating that the classifier or any of its components are validated biomarkers of disease status. Demonstrating that repeating the classifier development process and independent data results in the same classifier, there should be no requirement for that. That generally will not be what happens. FDA regulation of how DNA microarrays are used for classifier development, I think there should be no requirement for that. I think that would just be wasted effort.
Except for reproducibility, right?
I think when you have a classifier, you have to show that you can measure it reproducibly in some platform that you're going to use. But for sort of trying to standardize how you should normalize, how you know, all of the details that go into analyzing microarray data, I've published a book about them. I don't really think that that's anything that should be regulated.
Because, among other things, you never get the same result twice because it's tiny little differences and stuff like that.
If you do regression analyses with lots of variables having nothing to do with microarrays, you don't get the same set of predictors twice either. So.
Right.
When you have correlated variables, but anyway, I'm not going to go into this adaptive design where we don't have time. I'll just go straight to the conclusions. So new technology and biological knowledge make it increasingly feasible to identify which patients are most likely to benefit or suffer severe adverse events from a new treatment. The FDA, I think, can either expedite or slow the effective utilization of this technology. Overregulation of classifier development is a way of slowing it. Not providing sponsors with a clear and practical roadmap of how to use classifiers in evaluating drugs is also a way of slowing it. Targeting treatment can generally improve the therapeutic ratio of the benefits to adverse events. Smaller clinical trials in some cases are needed. Some cases, to use these things, we will have to have larger, somewhat larger clinical trials. But treated patients are more likely to benefit, and there'll be economic benefit to society. much of the conventional wisdom about how to develop and utilize biomarkers is flawed and does not lead to definitive evidence of treatment benefit for a well-defined population. Some aspects of the guidelines of the FDA on biomarkers are inappropriate for treatment selection biomarkers and are really tuned to surrogate endpoint kind of biomarkers. Technology is sufficiently mature today to effectively identify which patients benefit from new treatments in many cases, and to dramatically improve the efficiency of clinical trials. I think what is lacking is leadership in establishing specific guidelines for the design and analysis of adequate clinical trials that test new treatments in patient populations predefined based on completely specified diagnostic classifiers. Trial designs are available, although they need to be further developed, that will support broad labeling indications in cases where drug activity is sufficient and provide strong evidence of effectiveness for prospectively defined subsets where that's appropriate. And prospectively specified analysis plans for phase 3 data are essential to achieve reliable results. Biomarker analysis does not mean exploratory analysis except in developmental studies. Biomarker classifiers used in phase 3 evaluations should be completely specified based on external data. And in some cases, definitive evidence can be achieved from prospective analysis of patients in previously conducted clinical trials with extensive archival of pretreatment specimens. And collaborators Boris Friedland, Abubakar Medtournam, one of my past postdocs, and Sujay Moy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are running late, but it looks like we need to invite you back at some point to finish this conversation up. Okay, thank you very much.
The slides you didn't touch on, which are your adaptive design.